Hi, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist and I've been investigating mis- and disinformation. If you're worried that something that you're seeing, reading or hearing might be mis- or disinformation, especially if it made you feel panicked, angry or scared, then eSafety experts actually suggest that you stop and search for other pieces of reporting on the same topic by trusted sources on their own sites or channels. You can join me interrogating this dangerous world of disinformation by streaming my series, The Matter of Facts, right now on ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I was like, you know what? This is so toxic. I'm so done.
I said, I'm just terrified. I'm not going to see you again.
It's a really difficult, painful decision to make that causes a lot of grief.
We had our difficult moments, certainly, but nothing that I would have foreseen as ending up in an estrangement.
Families are weird and unique ecosystems from which we spawn. If we're lucky, we're born into a safe one where our needs are met and we turn into only mildly flawed adults. If we're lucky, we want to have dinner with our families and they want to be at the table. But what if our loved ones amputate us from their lives? And even though the process is violent and painful, they feel they're better off without us. Or what if, say like it is for the Beckhams, some relationships hurt too much to maintain? Or like Harry and Meghan, there's not just a boundary-crossing, creepy, weird uncle. There's a whole sea of family dysfunction that we want to keep our kids and ourselves safe from. Estrangement can be messy and create emotional pain that lasts for years or even a lifetime. On top of that, there's this feeling of failure because it's not the way that these things are meant to go, right? I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about family estrangement.
I knew things weren't right and I felt like I was walking on eggshells, and I thought all we need to do is have a talk about this.
This is Jessica. She's in her 50s and lives in coastal New South Wales. Jessica and her husband are the proud parents of three boys. But when her eldest was in his early 20s, she started to feel him pulling away from her. So she invited him out to dinner, just the two of them.
I remember it was along the lines of, have I done something wrong? I want to apologise for something I don't know I've done. And I remember him saying words to the effect of, I'm not going to keep in contact. And I just remember this sense of blind panic, and the rest of the evening is a bit of a blur. I was crying at the end, and he did ask where this was all coming from, all of my emotion. And I said, I'm just terrified. I'm not going to see you again. It was really overwhelming to suddenly realise that I was very powerless.
This news came as a shock to Jessica. She had loved being a mother to her boys. But she did notice from the time he was a teenager, her eldest son had a strong streak of independence.
I could see that he was restless. I could see that he wanted to do things his own way. And in a way, I admired that. I was like that as an adolescent as well. And I felt that was very normal. We had our difficult moments, certainly, but nothing that I would have foreseen as ending up in an estrangement.
Right. So he was a bit resistant to you, a bit grumpy?
At times, yes.
But I guess that's all teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as a mum, I was pretty grumpy sometimes too, you know, running my own business, having a super busy life and then expecting everybody just to fall into line when they needed to.
Yeah.
So I'd like to be fair and say that, you know, sometimes it was difficult for all of us.
It's only in retrospect that Jessica was able to appreciate how the imperfections in her parenting might have added up.
I just sort of thought if anything was really wrong, it's going to be a big thing and I'm going to notice it straight away. But on reflection, I realised that I just failed to see lots of little things.
After the dinner where her son told her he didn't want to see her anymore, Jessica held out hope that she could repair things, and there was contact between the two until his 22nd birthday.
I think I might have tried to call five times in the day. until I had that horrible realisation that maybe I've been blocked. And then I did check in with my other sons, whom he's still in some contact with, and said, I can't get through to him. And they said, well, maybe he's not going to pick up your call. And I think that was the first time I realised that the estrangement had started.
Mm. So what was that feeling like?
It was shock. I didn't know what to do. You really question everything you've done and thinking, I've been a bad mother, I've failed as a mother. It was just thinking that I'd had such good intent to be a good mother and that I loved being a mother.
Mm. So you were in a very heightened state of emotion around this relationship.
Very much so, very much.
How long did that heightened emotion last for?
I genuinely don't think that the shock wore off for well over a year.
Wow.
You know, I would still cry about it every day. I would think about him multiple times every day. And a lot of ruminating anxiety set in, which made it actually very difficult to move past the shock.
While Jessica had to come to terms with a choice that was out of her control, others contend with making that decision to walk away from a family member. I want you to meet Cody. She's 32 and a new mum. Growing up, Cody idolised her charismatic dad. He worked away a lot, but when he was home, he made her feel like a princess.
He'd take me on really extravagant weekends away. You know, we'd go to the city and I could pick out anything I wanted. You know, I remember I was 10 and he hired a Rolls Royce to take me around Sydney City. And we went to the Myer Shopping Centre. I got to pick out anything I wanted and I bought this beautiful Tommy Hilfiger gold watch. You know, at 10, it's like this amazing thing. You know, he'd call them daddy-daughter days. We'd always have really deep chats. My dad was a big talker. I got that from him, I think.
Yeah, and speaking of having good chats, your dad sat you down at 6 years old to have a serious conversation with you. What was the conversation?
My dad sat me down and told me that if I loved having one mummy, guess what, now I've got two, and sort of explained to me that daddy has a girlfriend, but I can't tell mummy. It's a big secret.
And wait on, were they together at the time?
They were together, yeah. So this like happened in my mum and dad's bedroom. I can remember it as clear as day.
Did you have any understanding at the time that asking a six-year-old to keep a secret like that is pretty transgressive?
Yeah, and I look back on my childhood and I'm like, there are so many things that you would just never do as a parent. And I don't know why I didn't tell my mum, because we're so close, but I guess I just respected what my dad asked me to do, you know, as a kid. Kids keep secrets, I guess.
This wasn't the only secret Cody's dad told her she needed to keep. He would also talk to her in hushed tones about his time as a soldier in Vietnam.
I always was told my dad was special forces, and so he was never allowed to talk to me about it. I was never allowed to tell anybody at school because it could get me in trouble, and we don't celebrate Anzac Day and we don't talk about it. And that was it.
If he served in the military, why wouldn't you celebrate Anzac Day?
Because he said that he lost all his friends in the war and it wasn't something to be celebrated.
Okay.
Because of how he was treated when he allegedly returned from Vietnam.
When she got to high school, Cody was working on a history project and very excitedly looked up her father's name on the military roll.
And I couldn't find my dad. And I remember being like, that's weird. Like, why would his name not be on that?
As Cody grew up, there were more implausible stories from her father. The spectre of his supposed war service loomed large. But Cody was starting to see that her dad was a fabulist, or what is sometimes known as a chronic bullshitter. He kept working the angles enough for doubt to linger, and a strong desire to trust him held on. But when she was in her early 20s, he gave her a box of his prized military medals.
The person I was dating at the time was a bit of a war buff, and he was like, well, there's a Purple Heart and that's an American thing, so these aren't your dad's medals. And it was at that point that I was like, okay, I'm so validated. I was like, yeah, it's a lie.
It broke something in Cody.
I just said something like, well, just so you know, I know it's all a lie and those medals that you apparently held so dearly are in the bin because I know that they're all fake. And then he just kept going on and on and on about the documents and that he's got this and he's got proof. I said, well, you don't have any proof, so I don't want to speak to you again.
But like a fish that thinks it's escaped the hook, Cody kept getting reeled back in. Her father would suddenly be gravely ill and, oops, that was the bait, because next minute, he would miraculously recover. Then there was the time he sued his employer for a fall at work that left him in a wheelchair.
But he would, when he didn't think you were looking, he'd be out of the wheelchair. And a part of me was like, huh. But he told me, oh, it's because I'm making really good strides in rehab and I've got to try and walk around a bit. But, you know, if anyone ever asks you, I'm completely wheelchair bound.
But would you believe this? Once the payout came through, Cody's dad was up and out of that chair.
This was really the point where I started to say, this is too much for me, like the cost that you've done on the health system and just completely defrauding everybody, including your family and everybody who knows you, is just wrong.
But it wasn't easy for Cody to get distance from her dad. The fake illnesses weren't just a tactic to milk his employers. He used them to keep his daughter close.
I sort of started to pull back from him, but then he would keep having all these medical episodes in like he was having a stroke and I'd get calls to be like, you need to come and say goodbye to your dad. He's palliative. He's going to die. And like we'd get to the hospital and we'd hear him talking. He's had like this miraculous recovery.
The thing about estrangement, particularly between families, is that the loss is what we might call an ambiguous loss.
What that means is that it's not black and white. Meet Dr. Kayla Steele, a clinical psychologist at the Black Dog Institute. She says whether you've cut a family member off or you're the one who's been cut off, there are some common emotions that come up.
Number one is the sense of loss that occurs and the grief that comes with that loss.
Unlike when someone dies and there's a clear ending to whatever the relationship was, with estrangement, it's murky.
There's a sense that the person is physically alive, but emotionally or physically distant or absent. And that can be particularly difficult for both parties.
Kayla, what are some of the common reasons for adults to be estranged from family members?
So it's never just one thing. What we see is typically that there's been some significant traumatic experience in the family. There could have been instances of abuse or neglect, whether that's physical, sexual, emotional abuse or neglect. There could be a repeated boundary violations or clashes when it comes to values or lifestyle differences.
Mm-hmm. So it's a misalignment of values that have gone on for a long time?
Sometimes even decades. I mean, no one really wakes up one day and makes a decision that they're going to cut themselves off completely from their family or estrange from their family. It's actually a really difficult and painful decision to make, and it's often the last resort.
The pain can also be crushing for the person being pushed away.
They can think, I don't understand why this is happening, and they can be feeling really confused about it. And that can be really frustrating for both parties when there's this misalignment or misunderstanding of the reality of the relationship.
Yeah. If you look on social media, there's trends like no contact, where children cut themselves off from their parents. I think Oprah hosted a special event about estrangement last year. So it's definitely in the zeitgeist. Tell me, in your opinion, does that mean that more people are cutting themselves off from family members, or is it just that we have more language around it?
Yeah, so I think it might be both and. I think family estrangement has always been around.
Yeah.
It's not like a new concept. But then at the same time, we are seeing more people talk about it. We're seeing it with, you know, the Beckham family is quite prevalent in the media at the moment. And recently, I think it was a Nickelodeon star, Jeanette McCurdy, wrote a really great book called I'm Glad My Mum Died.
How do you think estrangement is viewed broadly by society?
I think there's a lot of stigma around
it.
Yeah, because it really goes against the narrative of we have of like the perfect nuclear intact family. We have these fantasies around what family should look like. And I think that when there are differences in there or non-traditional family structures or estrangement, then that can really go against that sort of understanding of what family should be. There's a lot of judgment, I think, for the person who's both doing the estranging and being estranged around people not understanding why that would be happening or assuming really negative intent or negative circumstances that led to the estrangement.
Mum of three, Jessica, felt that shame of estrangement keenly when her son cut her out of his life. When friends and family asked after him, she was put on the spot.
I would just have to address, I guess the issue straight up was to say, I'm sure you're looking at me wondering what I've done to deserve this, because that's the stigma. And I'd say to them, I don't actually know what I've done, but I'm very heartbroken that this is the outcome.
Did this impact the family as a whole?
It did. And I feel, especially for his siblings, my other sons, I feel terrible because I was so overwhelmed by my own grief that I can't remember if I checked in with them to say, how are you feeling about it? Because to me, it was, well, he still kind of talks to you. He doesn't talk to me. So therefore, it's not as bad for you. But that really misses the point of that ripple effect of an estrangement and how it kind of changed the dynamic.
People have described family estrangement as having a missing person from your family. There's this sort of unresolved grief. There's a hollow or an empty chair. Is that how it felt for you?
Absolutely. And it's so ambiguous. And you just think, I dare not hope for a reconciliation because the disappointment, if that never happened, would be crushing.
What was the first Christmas like after the estrangement?
Oh, that was awful. I actually had nobody at home. Everybody had someplace better to be. And I understand that. I think I did 3 loads of washing. I mowed the lawn. I packed up the Christmas tree. And I think I thought that I might actually become the Christmas Grinch myself. That was really difficult.
What about Mother's Day?
Oh, that's horrible too.
Tell me more. What do you do on Mother's Day?
Well, I always like to go on a hike or a holiday so that I'm not around. Look, that's difficult because I think it's always really hard to reflect on that time to say, could I have been a better mother? And even if I had the chance to go back and change things, would I have been able to change it? I like to think I would have, but I'm not even sure what I need to change.
When Cody, daughter of the Rolls-Royce loving fantasist, decided to withdraw from her dad, she didn't realise just how many times she'd be pulled back into his net. But she managed to keep a distance and start a family of her own until a couple of years ago when she was contacted by a friend of her dad's.
He phoned me and said that your dad is on life support and he's probably not going to make it through the night. I said, okay, well, like, is there like photos of this? Because like I've been told this like a lot. And I got a photo of my dad intubated in ICU. So he, I guess, was genuinely sick.
Her father's prognosis was bad.
I was like, oh my God, I have so many emotions. People told me that this will hit you when that person dies and then you'll regret it. And I was like, it's happening. I said it wouldn't happen and it's happening. And I was so conflicted. I didn't know what to do, whether I opened that door again and said goodbye or if I just left it as it was. And then I decided, okay, put the phone next to his ear and I'll say goodbye.
What did you say?
He always called me Munchkin. So I said, hi, Dad, it's Munchkin and I'm sorry and I love you. And that was it. And I just left it and then I kept asking, like, has he passed away yet? And that went on for a day or two and then he woke up.
Cody.
And he's still alive to this day. It's been really complicated over the last probably 18 months because he knew that I had said goodbye and he saw that as an open door and I didn't know how to close it again.
Then there's the added complication of what to tell her kid about Grandpa.
I think, well, how do I explain to my son that where's my dad? Like, why does he only have one grandparent on mummy's side?
While she doesn't regret removing her dad from her life, there is still grief for Cody.
There's always a part of you that is like, that's your family. And even though he's the most disappointing person to me, he still gave me life and he gave me a good life. As far as I never wanted for anything, I am grateful for all of that. The good is dead in him, but I miss the good.
As for Jessica, she still misses her son, but she's been trying to focus her attention on the things she can control. A year or so after losing contact with her kid, Jessica's friend suggested they go on a hike.
I've never done anything so physically hard in my life. It was just one foot in front of the other, not even looking ahead because I would have been too demoralised as to the distance we had to cover. And then 7 hours later, we made it up to the top. I just couldn't stop crying. And I realised that it really was, this was exactly the experience I'd been through. This is something you didn't think you could do.
Yes.
And you know you're going to do it. And the relief you feel at the end that has really been very restorative.
Jessica's heart still breaks for the lost relationship with her son, but she now looks at things differently.
I now see that my role as a parent, first and foremost, was to raise somebody who would be confident and independent and able to make their own way in the world. Mm. And I feel that he's able to do that and he's free to do that. To some extent, I think you have to let them go in your heart a little bit to say, I only want the best for you. And if the best for you is being estranged, then I have accepted that.
Jessica's reached a place where she's found some kind of peace with her situation. For others, there might be a chance to reconnect.
It does take work on both sides. I think initially what needs to happen is that needs to be a sort of acceptance of some personal responsibility, ideally on both sides. So if I can accept my role in our relationship difficulties and our relationship breakdown, and you can accept your role in our relationship difficulties or breakdown, that creates almost like a more even playing field mm-hmm. in which we're then able to have a difficult conversation around how to move forward.
Dr. Kayla says once both parties have come to the table, it's about finding ways to move forward, which may look different for each person.
And for the person who's putting in place the distance, this often means that they need to be really clear on what their boundaries are and what sort of behaviour they are able to sort of tolerate or work with and what are the hard lines for them, and then communicating that clearly. And then it's up to the other person to decide, can I actually work within that system? Can I work with this relationship, and can we try to move forward together rather than apart?
Sometimes, though, there's been too much hurt, too much messiness, and reconnection isn't possible. And that's okay too.
Research does suggest that overwhelmingly people who make the decision to estrange themselves from family members say that it was the right decision for them and that they feel better in themselves, even though there are difficulties, of course, they feel better in themselves for having made that decision.
Kayla says that for those who have been cut off from a loved one, turning towards positive experiences can help.
I do have a sense that the feeling of loss will always be felt in some way, but I like the idea of thinking about it as filling up your life with lots of different positive things so that the loss doesn't feel so big and take up so much space. It's not the only thing in your life or the only thing that dictates your life.
Despite the grief, Cody is still clear that not having her father in her life is the right thing to do. She's cuddling into her new little family, knowing her dad is unwelcome in her baby son's life.
I know fundamentally my dad, there was a part of him that would love this. And then the other part of him that just, for whatever reason, was so compulsive in his lies that completely prevented him from any kind of happiness or long-term stability.
Are you excited to be the kind of parent that you wanted to have?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm really lucky. I had an amazing mum, and I shape a lot of my parenting and what I want to be as a parent from her.
I reckon there'll be somebody listening who's like, I'm thinking about cutting this person off from my life. Now, what do you want to say to that person who's thinking about it?
I think that you have to block out the noise of other people's opinions and do what feels fundamentally right for you. But it is complex, and there are lots of emotions, good and bad, and you just have to ride the wave and find someone to help you if you need.
Okay.
Professional or non-professional.
But yeah, professional help, highly recommend. Yeah.
Love a bit of therapy.
Yes. Little prayer for all the therapists that have helped us
therapists.
Through.
Yeah.
And isn't that the message of nearly every episode of this podcast? That you have to block out the noise of other people's opinions and do what feels right for you. The unique thing about family is that they're the people who've known you your whole life. It can be beautiful if that relationship makes you feel seen and truly known. But when the relationship goes wrong and those bonds are severed, it can be heart-wrenching. Being cut off can be a singularly excruciating experience, and the haunting pain of that amputation can last a lifetime. But being the amputator comes with its own flavour of pain. often the love still exists, but the distance, for whatever reason, is too far to bridge. For both parties, it's not easy and mostly awful. So for that reason, again, ladies, a prayer for the therapists. This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gundungurra, Gadigal and Muwinina peoples. Ladies, We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, produced by Elsa Silberstein and Sarah Mashman. Supervising producer is Tamar Cranswick, and our executive producer is Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Claudine Ryan.